This is All Things Considered from NPR News. I'm Alyssa Block.
And I'm Michelle Norris. The U.S. women's soccer team is playing on shaky ground at the World Cup in Germany. Yesterday, the team lost to Sweden 2-1. And that means the U.S. moves on to face Brazil on Saturday, a major obstacle to the hopes of reclaiming the World Cup title. Our regular sports commentator, Stefan Fatsis, is in Germany. He was at that U.S.-Sweden game. He's also seen Brazil play this week. Hello, Stefan. Guten Tag.
Guten Tag, Michelle.
So last night's game was the first ever loss for the U.S. women's team in group play. What went wrong?
Well, the U.S. looked a little unstable at times on defense, and Sweden exploited some lapses in the midfield. And both of those factors led to the Swedish goals. One was on a penalty kick. The other was off a deflection on a free kick. But from where I was sitting in the stands, the U.S. controlled the game. The main problem last night and earlier in this tournament has been the Americans' failure to convert their ample scoring chances. A lot of shots wide or high or right at the opposing goalkeeper. That's going to have to change.
And now before we look ahead to Brazil, I have to ask, what was that little dance they did on the field?
You know, I didn't get an answer to that, but I think that is a tradition with the Swedish players. They get in a little huddle and dance. In Europe, you see a lot of that sort of group hug dance after a goal or a win.
It looked like they were doing the hokey pokey or something like that. As we look ahead, what should we be looking for in that U.S. game Saturday against Brazil?
Well, this is a quarterfinals knockout game. Loser goes home. The U.S. did not expect to have to face one of the favorites. The Americans were seeded first here, Germany second, Brazil third. They weren't expecting to play one of those two teams until the semifinals. The big risk on Saturday is the gifted Brazilian forward, Marta. She has the most deceptive and sophisticated moves in women's soccer. And Brazil, while far from unbeatable so far, has improved as the tournament has progressed. Marta and her fellow forwards are fast, and the U.S. defense has occasionally looked plodding, so that's the pressure point right there.
Stefan, last week when we spoke to you, you mentioned that there weren't many U.S. fans at the team's opening game against North Korea. Different scene in that game against Sweden?
Yeah, definitely more USA wigs and face paint, though still outnumbered by singing Swedes this time. But what's really surprised me has been the lack of a U.S. media presence in Germany. ESPN is here full on. They're showing all the games on TV back home. But otherwise, the first round American media contingent was three writers. A few more are expected for the knockout stages, but still not that many.
Why so few reporters? A sign of the recession?
Yeah, budgets are tight. You can do more from farther away these days, but the U.S. women's team is a victim of its own success in some ways. The attitude among a lot of media is they're going to make it past the early stages. Let's wait to cover them live. Wait until they play a game in which they might be eliminated. And the irony is that this is the one sport in which the United States has been hugely successful and also which has generated mainstream media attention for women's sports. Coverage is discounted, though, because of that success.
Now, the U.S. did strut into this contest, but now the path isn't looking so sure for the team with yesterday's loss. Is this turning into a very different narrative?
Well, I'd venture that some of the media that were on the fence about using their credentials are going to be going forward with it now. But the story already had changed. The U.S. helped popularize women's soccer globally, dominated it for a long time, and that, when you combine it with the feature aspect, look at how empowering this is for girls. It gives them a team of athletes to identify with and root for, something that didn't really exist before. That made it a great cross-platform story. And the gender aspect is still there. There were dozens of teens and preteen girls, including my daughter, leaning over the stadium wall in Wolfsburg, Germany last night to get post-game autographs from a couple of U.S. players. But precisely because the Americans don't dominate the way they once did, it should be a more compelling sports story.
So beyond the U.S. And Brazil on Saturday, who else is still standing?
Well, the other matches are going to be Sweden against Australia, England, France, and the host and two-time defending champion Germany against Japan. And after a shaky start and some local controversy over the performance and benching of a star player, Germany seems to be back on track. But my big observation about the Germans, Michelle, is the wacky font that the team is using on its jerseys. It's like the bastard child of Comic Sans. And from what I've dug up online, it's a free font called Action Man, and it is plainly ridiculous on the back of a sports uniform.
Stefan, always good to talk to you. Have fun over there.
Thanks, Michelle.
That's Stefan Fatsis. He speaks with us regularly about sports and the business of sports. He's calling us this time from Germany, where he's been attending the Women's World Cup. From NPR News, this is All Things Considered. I'm Michelle Norris.
I'm Alyssa Block. And just around the corner from our studios here in Washington, I went out to stalk the wild weed. Those stubborn plants happily thriving, pushing up through gravel and brick.
This back alley gets obviously, you know, no care whatsoever.
My guide is horticulturist Graham Davis with the Smithsonian Gardens. And in this alley, among empty cigarette packs, broken glass, tossed away cups and straws, he's finding an impressive array of plant life. Spurge, thistles, plantain, chickweed.
Well, it looks like we've got some nightshade, which is this.
Sort of tall and leafy.
Yeah. And then down here we've got, I think this is groundsel, and they have an amazing taproot that goes very deep into the soil, so it can extract water from deeper levels, so as the soil dries out, it still can tap into moisture and do quite
these
well.
These are very tall. There's one here that must be, gosh, it's about as tall as I am. It's over 5 feet tall.
There's a tiny little crease in the asphalt here.
And that's what they found.
You know,
a little bit
of
dirt.
About a half an inch, maybe? And they don't seem to be bothered at all being back here.
So it's just this ribbon of green down the alleyway.
Yeah, and left undisturbed, they'll be here forever.
Graham Davis got his start in weed science, which he admits is really being a glutton for punishment.
Because it's sort of the subset of plants that, you know, are problematic. There's not a whole lot of glory. You're not, like, cultivating roses or growing trees or something that's beneficial. You're sort of dealing with the problem child.
As with dealing with a problem child, it really depends on how much you love them.
That's the prominent British nature writer Richard Mabey.
If you're prepared to engage with them and try to see the world from their point of view, exactly as with problem children, you probably get on with them a lot better and maybe reach a modus vivendi with them that head-on assault fails.
Richard Mabey has published his own spirited defense of weeds. He calls them vegetable gorillas, forest outlaws, in his new book titled Weeds, in Defense of Nature's Most Unloved Plants. His love of weeds started when he discovered a forest of disreputable plants in an industrial wasteland near Heathrow Airport.
I was just astonished at the redemption that these places were getting by their vegetable growth. And these were covered in this rampant growth of plants from, you know, probably four continents. There was buddleia from Southeast Asia. There was Japanese knotweed from much the same area. Giant hogweed, enormous 18-foot-tall umbellifer from the Caucasus. And together they made a vegetation that is probably not like that anywhere else on the planet. And it seemed to me profoundly inspiring that this kind of post-industrial wasteland was actually producing this growth. It seemed to say something about the obstinacy and resilience of nature that spoke to me.
When you think about redemption of blighted landscapes, you give the example of what happened after the bombing around Britain in World War II, the devastating bombing of cities, where weeds took over and reclaimed these areas that had been utterly destroyed.
Yeah, that's right. The invasion was also weirdly atavistic, because about 2 miles away from the very centre of the Blitz in London, maybe some 70 years before, there'd been a big excavation, and archaeologists and botanists had moved in, and they were able to reconstruct from the layers of central London what vegetation had flourished in London maybe 20,000 years ago. And it was precisely the same as had come up after the bombing.
What were those weeds that were springing up in those?
Many
those
of them will be very familiar to you, including the plant you found in your walk, plantain and chickweed, but also stuff like dandelion and field poppy, buttercups, horsetails, mare's tails, plants which continue to be extraordinarily familiar.
You spend a great deal of time talking about particularly strong and resilient weed called bindweed, and I'd like you to describe just how bindweed spreads, how potent it can be.
Okay, well, I'm sure it doesn't need any introduction to
I'm
to
a little
anyone.
Familiar with it myself, yeah.
I think it's one of the most wily weeds. If you actually try to cut it up, which is what gardeners very often do when they're hoeing bindweed, they think, aha, we'll kill the beast, lamb it with a hoe and cut it into 100 pieces, you've simply created another 100 bindweed plants, because each one of those little cut white threads of root or stem can produce a new mother plant. The number of things that bindweed is capable of doing are really quite awesome. The growing tip of a bindweed can find its way out of a maze inside a perfectly black box with just one pinprick of light.
I'm curious, Richard, maybe where your defense of weeds ends and your respect for them. I mean, when you talk about invasive species especially that are just taking over entire swaths of countries, maybe kudzu in our country in the south, at what point do you say, you know, this is a problem? My respect ends and it is a real problem.
No, it unquestionably is a problem. And in earlier agricultural periods, people understood the relationship between what they did and the growth of the weeds that resulted. And I think we've lost that because we're so distanced from plants generally. And they're now thought, we now respond by a kind of a reflex, not by reasoning. And we don't think through and ask that question, why is this weed here?
What would you say to people, maybe to gardeners, who do look at weeds, and I'm sure I'm in this category, as things to be rooted out, as things that are upsetting the balance of a garden and the enemy, in a sense?
Well, I think that's entirely understandable, and I do it myself. So I would say, please don't think for a moment that this defense of these plants is saying that we can regard them absolutely complacently. All I would ask is we ask those significant questions, you know, why is this weed here? What is it doing? And I think that if one kind of can reach those two areas, then the response to them can be much more intelligent.
Richard, maybe I'd like to end by having you read a small section from your book where you're basically making the case for meeting weeds on their own terms. This is on page 37.
Okay. Just let me get me spectacles. Weeds as a type are mobile, prolific, genetically diverse. They're unfussy about where they live, adapt quickly to environmental stress, use multiple strategies for getting their own way. It's curious that it took us so long to realize that the species they most resemble is us.
Richard Mabee, his book is titled Weeds in Defense of Nature's Most Unloved Plants. Richard Mabee, thanks so much.
Thank you very much. Enjoyed it.
Listening to All Things Considered from NPR News.
I'm Michelle Martin, and this is Tell Me More from NPR News. Coming up, gay rights activists have scored some major political victories in recent years, and polls show more people than ever are accepting of same-sex relationships. So why are as many as half of LGBT white-collar employees still in the closet at work? We'll talk about a new study that revealed that finding in a few minutes. But first, we want to talk about another major concern of Americans: education. Even as the nation's political leaders work to resolve their differences over the nation's budget deficit and debt, education is still very much on the minds of many, if not most, Americans. At President Obama's Twitter town hall meeting yesterday, for example, moderator and Twitter co-founder Jack Dorsey estimated that 10% of the questions touched on the needs of America's schools and how they're coping with strained budgets. This is just part of the president's response. Here it is.
We do have to pay for good teachers. Young, talented people aren't going to go into teaching if they're getting paid a poverty wage. We do have to make sure that buildings aren't crumbling. It's pretty hard for kids to concentrate if there are leaks and it's cold and there are rats running around in their schools. And that's true in a lot of schools around the country.
The man tasked with helping to keep American schools on the right track is Education Secretary Arne Duncan. He has presided over the Obama administration's signature education program, Race to the Top, and he sought to address complaints about the Bush administration's key education law, No Child Left Behind. Secretary Duncan has spent nearly 20 years working on education reform, and he's on the line now from his office in Washington, D.C. Welcome back. Thanks for joining us once again.
Thanks for having me, Michelle. Thanks for the opportunity.
I'd like to ask you about one of those questions that the president was addressing at the town hall meeting on Twitter yesterday, which is, what about the fact that the country is in tough economic times and many state and local budgets are squeezed and the schools are taking a hit? We find that, you know, summer school's being curtailed in many places. We find that teachers are being laid off in some places. How are your strategies for education reform being affected, or are they being affected by these budget realities?
Yeah, well, there's no upside when state and local governments are cutting back. And these are tough economic times, as you know, Michelle, at every level, state and local and federal. And what the president is trying to do is lead by example and walk the walk. And in these very tough economic times, when he basically flatlined the rest of domestic spending, he asked for a $4 billion increase in our budget, in education's budget. What he fundamentally sees is that education is an investment, not an expense, and that where folks cut back, that's penny wise but pound foolish. This is the best investment we can make. So I've challenged all 50 governors. I've challenged local political leaders that, you know, when you cut back in early childhood education, when you go from 5-day weeks to 4-day weeks, when you eliminate extracurriculars and art and PE and music, you absolutely hurt your children and ultimately you hurt your state. And so budgets, Michelle, reflect our priorities. They reflect our values. And we either care about children and we're going to continue to invest in them, or we're not.
I wanted to talk about an education story that's making headlines now. A Georgia State investigation revealed on Tuesday that 178 teachers and principals in the Atlanta public school system cheated on standardized tests. And they're saying that part of it is that there's just too much riding on test scores now, and it creates an environment where people are desperate, and desperate people cheat. What do you make of that?
Yeah, well, you always want to balance. But at the end of the day, Michelle, what's so disturbing there is this was clearly part of the culture. This was endemic. And I think approximately 80% of schools had cheating in it. So this wasn't an isolated incident. Ultimately, Michelle, it's just real simple. When adults do these kinds of things, they just hurt children. They cheat children. There are children here who didn't get the help they needed, didn't get the support they needed because they were lied to.
But why do you think this happened, though? I mean, are you saying that why did this culture exist? Do you think these are just bad people, or they're lacking in morality?
I have no idea on the details there. But at the end of the day, what I care about is, you know, are we helping children fulfill their tremendous academic and social potential? Are they getting the support they need? And clearly, there was a culture here that at some levels was rotten.
And obviously, there's a lot of debate about the role that the No Child Left Behind standards play in that environment. There are people clearly on both sides of that conversation. But you testified before Congress in March that the vast majority of public schools would not meet some No Child Left Behind standards by 2014, and you called on Congress to reform the policy. What's the status of that?
Yeah, well, the law is fundamentally broken. And the law is far too punitive, far too prescriptive. It's led to a dumbing down of standards. It's led to a narrowing of the curriculum. And what I'm so angry about, Michelle, is that if whatever the number is, 75-80% of schools are labeled as failures with the current law, that's dishonest. It's not true. We absolutely have schools that are struggling. They absolutely have schools that we want to challenge the status quo. But many, many schools are doing an amazing job. And as we talked about at the start of the conversation, doing a great, great job in very tough economic times. And so to label schools that are getting better each year as failures, that's demoralizing to hardworking teachers and principals. It's confusing to parents. It's confusing to the community. And so we've challenged Congress to fix the law. And we want to fix it together in a bipartisan way. And we want to fix it with a real sense of urgency. I absolutely hope that happens. But if it doesn't happen, I'm prepared to use our waiver authority to provide some relief now to states and to districts that are doing this hard work.
If you're just joining us, you're listening to Tell Me More from NPR News. We're talking to Education Secretary Arne Duncan about contemporary issues in the news that affect education. Here's an issue that you testified in Congress about recently, the DREAM Act. It's a proposed law that would create a pathway to citizenship for many children who were brought to this country without proper authorization by their parents when they were children. In congressional testimony last week, you talked in support of the DREAM Act. How do you see this as an educational issue?
I'm a passionate supporter of the DREAM Act. And quite frankly, Michelle, I think as a country, we have our priorities absolutely backwards on this. To deny young children who have, you know, come to this country, their parents brought them, sometimes when they were infants, they've worked hard, they've gone to school, they've gotten good grades, they've been community leaders, to deny them the chance to go to college is absolutely crazy. And we need their talents. We need their expertise. We need their creativity. We need their ingenuity. We need them to create the jobs of the future. And so it's two things. One, it's just an issue of fairness. To not give them a chance to go to college is simply un-American. It's not fair. And secondly, as a country, we have, a selfish interest that we need their talents, and we either want them to be the next generation of teachers and entrepreneurs and engineers and innovators, or they're going to be stuck doing, you know, under the table, you know, small-time jobs the rest of their life, you know, for cash.
Well,
it's got to change.
It's obviously a very emotional issue for many people on both sides of the question. What about people like Texas Republican Senator John Cornyn, who argue that this creates a reward? It's actually a reward for people who have broken the law. This is what he said last week. So I'm just going to play a short clip from his response last week on Congress, just so that people have a sense of what some of the other side of the argument is. Here it is.
What parent would not be tempted to immigrate illegally on the hope that, if not they, but maybe their children would be given the gift of American citizenship?
How do you respond to that point of view?
Well, it's simply not true. First of all, these young people haven't broken the law. They've done nothing wrong. And in fact, many of them have been exemplary, you know, youngsters and teenagers and community leaders. It's as if, you know, if I did something wrong, Michelle, it's as if my children would receive that penalty rather than me. That's just not how we worked. Secondly, in terms of, you know, creating an incentive, you know, longer term for folks to come here, the way the bill is written is that you would have to have been in this country for 5 years prior to the passage of the law to qualify to get this financial aid. You would have to be in good standing, and there's nothing on a forward basis that would allow folks who come to this country tomorrow to participate. So these are, again, these are red herrings. It doesn't reflect reality, and it doesn't reflect the urgent need we have. We have, in these tough economic times, Michelle, we have about 2 million high-wage, high-skilled jobs that are unfilled today because we don't have the talent to fill those jobs. And when we have all these smart, committed, talented young people who have the potential to fill those jobs and to be productive citizens and to pay taxes and to contribute to society, to deny that opportunity doesn't make sense. The final point I'll make on this is that the Congressional Budget Office, which is, you know, nonpartisan, has estimated that over the next 10 years, if we educate these young people, if we allow them to go to college, this will actually reduce the deficit by $1 billion because of their increased productivity. So at a time when we're trying to, you know, reduce the deficit and to put everything on the table, where we have something that increases productivity, reduces the deficit by $1 billion, to not look at that in these tough economic times, which, again, just doesn't make any sense whatsoever.
Finally, before we let you go, we wanted to ask you about a program that you launched earlier this year with movie director Spike Lee. It's an effort to recruit, train, place, and develop 80,000 African-American male teachers by the year 2015. We just haven't had a chance to talk to you about this initiative since you initiated it. Tell us what it's about, and why do you feel this is important, and how is it going?
Yeah, this is so important. And I just worry a lot, Michelle, that increasingly our teacher workforce doesn't reflect the tremendous diversity of our nation's young people. And if you look across the country today, less than 2%, less than 1 in 50 of our teachers is an African-American male. Less than 2% is a Latino male. And then we wonder why our young boys of color struggle. And I just want our teacher workforce to reflect the tremendous diversity of the country. So we anticipate over the next 4, 5, 6 years, we're going to need as many as 1 million new teachers in this country as the baby boomers retire. And to bring in this great next generation of talent will change public education for the next 30 years. So it's been a lot of fun. I've been out many places around the country. We have another teach event scheduled in August. We have a website, teach.gov, that I encourage people to look at. But I just can't think of anything more important. And if people want to contribute to the community, if they want to give back, if they want to help to transform lives, there's nothing more rewarding, nothing more important they can do than to become a teacher. What, and we're going to continue to push this very, very hard.
What's the sell, though, when these kids will be picking up the newspapers and reading about teacher layoffs in places that they may very well want to teach? What's the sell?
Yeah, well, again, we have to look over the horizons. I just said we're going to need as many as 1 million new teachers over the next 6 years. So we're going to be, as a country, despite the tough economic times, we're actually going to be hiring between 100,000 and 200,000 teachers every single year. And so these are tough times, no question. But the reality is we're going to have about a third third of our teacher workforce retire. So there is actually tremendous need out there. And again, I just can't think of a better way to make a difference and to contribute to the community. And all of us are where we are today because we had great teachers in our lives. And there's no better role you can play, no greater impact you can have than in the classroom.
Arne Duncan is the U.S. Secretary of Education. He was kind enough to join us on the phone from his office in Washington, D.C. Mr. Secretary, thank you so much for joining us.
Thanks. Have a great day. Take care now.
It's Morning Edition from NPR News. I'm Steve Inskeep.
And I'm Renee Montaigne. It may not be the end of the world, but it is the end of the news of the world. Rupert Murdoch's media company, News Corp, took the dramatic step yesterday of announcing that this Sunday would mark the last edition of the News of the World, the scandal-tarred British tabloid. That may or may not contain the damage. This morning, Prime Minister David Cameron called for a full investigation into the phone hacking scandal. And at almost the same time, police arrested Andrew Coulson, a former top aide to Cameron, who was editor of News of the World when the phone hacking occurred. NPR media correspondent David Folkenflik reports from London.
James Murdoch is the heir apparent at News Corp and the head of the company's British operations. In a television interview yesterday, Murdoch said the allegations of widespread illegal phone hacking reflected deplorable behavior and required the paper's closure.
This company has been a great investor in journalism, a greater investor in media in general, and it's something that we believe very strongly in. And clearly, certain activities did not live up to those standards. And that's a matter of great regret for me personally and for the company.
The scandal erupted at the most delicate of moments. News Corp is seeking government approval to expand its stake in the broadcaster BSkyB from about 40% to the whole shebang. Think of BSkyB as a hybrid of Comcast and DirecTV with a near monopoly on televised sports. It was considered a done deal, especially given Prime Minister David Cameron's close ties to News Corp executives. But outrage mounted quickly and intensely when it was alleged that the tabloid targeted victims of violent crimes and the July 2005 terror bombings. Once pliant politicians denounced the company, and once lonely critics have now found a crowd.
This is clearly a commercial decision in part to jettison a tainted and toxic brand because advertisers were fleeing in droves. And also we as MPs are being inundated with emails from and calls from constituents asking us to stand up to News International.
That's Labour MP Paul Farrelly. He led a parliamentary inquiry into the first wave of allegations involving the hacking of celebrities, royals and politicians.
We have some very serious and very good quality newspapers, but at the other end of the spectrum, we have the News of the World, and they are feral. They have clearly, over a long period of time, decided that they are above the law and that anything goes in getting a story.
But the decision to kill the paper has generated a reaction that has ranged from skepticism to cynicism. The actor Hugh Grant has said he believes he too was hacked and has publicly called on advertisers to boycott News of the World. He spoke to the BBC after James Murdoch's announcement.
We should see this for what it is. It is a very cynical managerial maneuver which has put several hundred not evil people, there were certainly a lot of evil people there, but a lot of certainly non-editorial staff out of work, and has kept, in particular, one woman who was the editor while Millie Dowler was being hacked in a highly paid job.
Millie Dowler was the schoolgirl whose abduction 9 years ago apparently inspired the tabloid to hack into her voicemail messages. Rebecca Brooks, then the paper's editor, is now the chief executive over the Murdoch's British newspapers. James Murdoch stated his support of her yesterday.
I am satisfied that Rebecca, her leadership of this business, and her standard of ethics and her standard of conduct throughout her career are very good. And I think what she's shown and what we have shown with our actions around transparently and proactively working with the police, that actually she has led and this company has led.
Nonetheless, the British government has delayed ruling on the company's proposed takeover of BSkyB, and News Corp signaled it might launch a Sunday edition of its brash and gossipy weekday tabloid, The Sun. Conveniently, it could replace the gap left by the departure of that oh-so-nettlesome News of the World. David Folkenflik, NPR News, London.
In the early 1990s, South Central Los Angeles had become synonymous with gang violence, drive-by shootings, and crack cocaine. In March 1991, the videotape beating of Rodney King showed a city whose police force seemed out of control. In this environment, 20 years ago this month, the movie Boys in the Hood exploded off the screen. It was the work of a young director just out of film school.
It's hard to be a saint in South Central L.A.
Morning Edition commentator John Ridley has this look back.
In 1990, Stephanie Allain was one of the few female and very few executives of color at a major Hollywood studio, Columbia Pictures. In May of that year, Stephanie was busy looking for someone to fill her old job of reading scripts for the studio.
And I heard about a kid who was still in school who was interested in the job. So I called him up. Little John shows up in my office, and he starts telling me about the script that he wrote. And he's telling me how he's going to direct it and this and that, and he's not in school, but he has an agent. And I'm thinking, okay, this kid's not really a reader. He's a writer. Let me read the script.
The kid was 22-year-old John Singleton. John had a script called Boys in the Hood that told the story of Trey, Ricky, and Doughboy. Three friends growing up with dreams of one day moving beyond their violent circumstances in South Central.
Y'all want to see a dead body?
Yeah.
Trey's daddy blasted at somebody last night.
Really? What kind of gun your daddy got?
The script focused on the relationship of Trey Styles and his father, Furious, a single parent trying to instill values in his troubled son, contrary to the pressures and temptations of his environment.
You know, Trey, you may think I'm being hard on you right now, but I'm not. What I'm doing is I'm trying to teach you how to be responsible. It's like your little friends across the street, they don't have anybody to show them how to do that. They don't. You're going to see how they end up, too.
It's the story that a lot of those cats used to make in the 80s in the suburbs, but made in the hood.
The film's writer and director, John Singleton.
I loved those pictures at that time, but I also felt alienated because none of those people look like me. So me and my friends would catch the bus up to Hollywood, and we go see the movies, and then we spend the whole time going down Vermont talking about what movies we would make. It would always be something like what I did with Boys in the Hood.
The script was written with a power and immediacy that absolutely floored Stephanie Allain.
It was one of those moments where I closed my door, I sat, and I read it in one sitting, and I was devastated. And I closed it, and I thought, okay, this is what I'm here to do.
You bad. You gotta shoot somebody now. Look, I'm sorry about your friend. My heart goes out to his mother and his family, but that's their problem, Trey. You my son. You my problem.
A lot of people don't really understand what it is to be young, black, and male and grow up in L.A. It's like you're taught to have the potential to explode. You know, it's like if a person looks at you wrong or somebody, a certain slight could turn into like, you know, boom.
It's that perspective that John wanted to put on screen. Never mind he'd never done a feature film before. John was determined to direct the script himself. Stephanie Allain recalls at one point the studio tried to bribe John into letting someone else direct the movie.
He was offered like $100,000 just to walk away. You know, what would you say if we gave you $100,000? And John was so cool. I was so proud of him. He was like, I'd say this conversation's over.
John began casting the film focusing on the lead role, Trey Styles. Eventually, the part went to a very pre-Oscar-winning Cuba Gooding Jr., still just a kid himself, on the hustle for his next gig.
You got to remember, this was early in my career. I didn't know what stage direction was. I didn't know what EXT, INT, period. I didn't know that meant exterior, interior. I didn't know we were outdoors or indoors. I just knew my lines. I knew Trey's lines. I knew his father, Furious, is mad at him. And I knew that emotion. That's how I came to this story.
Singleton went on to fill out the cast with established veteran Lawrence Fishburne, as well as what would become a who's who of actors. Angela Bassett, Regina King, Morris Chestnut, Nia Long, and in his first role as an actor, rapper Ice Cube. Cuba Gooding Jr. remembers the relative inexperience of the cast didn't keep them from sensing that something special was happening.
None of us knew what we were involved with. We just knew that we had nothing to lose to put our whole body, heart, and soul into these roles. And that's exactly what we were looking to do.
Trey, what happened? Trey, what happened? Talk to me. What happened?
Go home.
What happened to Ricky?
Go home. Trey. Trey!
Talk to him. Something just happened to Rick. I don't know. It just got shot. Something happened to Rick.
Wait, now.
In watching the film, it's truly amazing that the 22-year-old singleton was able to coax such mature performances from his cast. It helped that John was able to take directing lessons from Francis Ford Coppola by way of Lawrence Fishburne, who'd previously worked with Coppola on Apocalypse Now.
This before we even started, I said, I need to know everything. Tell me everything you did that Francis taught you as an actor. And we sat in my little apartment and everything. He'd say they would read the script and they would do improvisations that had to do with the characters and nothing to do with the script, to flesh out the characters. He says, and then we'd eat a lot of pasta and drink some wine and stuff, right?
Once completed, the film was instantly recognized as being extraordinary. It became an official selection in the 1991 Cannes Film Festival, and on July 12th, Boys in the Hood opened nationally to both critical and financial success. It took in nearly $60 million at the box office, and Boys earned Singleton an Academy Award nomination for Best Original Screenplay and Best Director. He was both the youngest and the first Black American to be nominated in the director category. In the two decades since, John Singleton has gone on to write, direct, and produce films that have earned nearly $500 million at the box office, including Shaft and Too Fast, Too Furious. But Boys in the Hood remains his signature piece. Stephanie Elaine.
After 20 years and having seen the movie so many times, I still cry. It's still very powerful.
In 1991, John Singleton just wanted to make a movie with characters that look like him. 20 years later, it's clear that he's left us with a powerful documentation of the pains and hopes and dreams of an entire city.
Ooh, child, things are gonna be easier.
Ooh, Morning Edition's John Ridley is an author and screenwriter. The anniversary edition Blu-ray of Boys in the Hood is out this month, and you can see the cast on set then and see where they are now at NPR.org. This is Morning Edition from NPR News. I'm Renee Montaigne.
And I'm Steve Inskeep. It's Morning Edition from NPR News. Good morning. I'm Steve Inskeep.
And I'm Renee Montaigne. We half expected by now to find that the shuttle Atlantis would not launch after all. It had been raining all morning. But in the last few minutes, NASA TV images have shown the crew suiting up, even waving to the cameras. A quick hi, Mom, or I love you.
Weather permitting, the shuttle will blast off at 11:26 Eastern Time from Florida's Kennedy Space Center. We're going to check in with correspondents in several locations over the next few minutes, beginning with NPR's Nell Greenfield-Boyce, who was at the Kennedy Space Center. Hi, Nell.
Good morning.
So is this launch really going to happen?
Well, that is the big question, and only time will tell, as they say. Right now, I'm looking across a grassy field. I can see the space shuttle in the launch pad off in the distance. There's a big countdown clock here next to an American flag. It's a big digital clock, and it is counting down. A few minutes ago, we just saw the four astronauts go by in the silver Astro van. That's a historic vehicle that's been carrying shuttle crews to the pad since the early 1980s, so since the early days of the shuttle program.
So it's not like a late model automobile. Mobile then, I guess.
No. It's a very retro-looking vehicle.
Can I just mention that as you're looking at what you're looking at, we're looking at NASA TV, the astronaut, the pilots are actually being fixed into position inside the shuttle, and we just saw one of them handling what looked like a sheaf of paper, like little handwritten notes or some kind of printout of some kind, which he put in a clip and put off to the side. It looked like he could have been sailing a ship 100 years ago or something like that.
Oh, sure. I'm sure they have all kinds of little cheat sheets to help them out. But all four astronauts on this mission are veteran astronauts who've flown before, so they know the drill.
Yeah, let me ask you, Nell, you've covered many launches, and of course this is a very, very high-profile launch, of course the last one. How does it compare?
Well, I mean, obviously the level of media interest is much higher. I mean, there's a huge number of reporters here. I think 2,000 people have press credentials. There's cameras everywhere. But in addition to that, there's a sort of historic feeling. I mean, everybody is aware that if this goes up today, if the weather cooperates, this will be the final time we see a space shuttle launch. And for the workers here at Kennedy Space Center, that really means a lot. I mean, there are people who've been working here for 20, 30 years. They've put their lives and their hearts into this program. And there's a bittersweet feeling. feeling that, you know, this is coming to an end. I mean, there's a sense of pride and accomplishment, but there's this feeling like, wow, you know, this could really be it.
And we have a member of the flight crew giving a thumbs up as he lies there in his orange suit. And let's go now. Nell, stay with us. Let's just bring another voice into the conversation. NPR's Wade Goodwin is across the Gulf of Mexico from you at the Johnson Space Center in Houston, which is Mission Control. Wade, good morning.
And are we losing Wade there? We got you. Wade Goodwin, are you there?
Can you hear me?
There we go.
Yes, there
we
go.
What's the mood like, Wade?
Well,
I guess we won't find out what the mood is like from Wade Goodwin. Perhaps you can hang up and try for a better phone line there, Wade Goodwin. Don't worry about it. We'll get back to you in a moment.
And if we could move back to Nell then just for a moment. There was a question I had for her, which is, almost lost in all of the excitement is the fact that this may be the last mission, but it does have a mission.
That's right. The shuttle will be going up to the International Space Station on a 12-day mission. The shuttle is stocked with all kinds of supplies for the station, a lot of food, a month's worth of food, spare parts. Basically, you know, the shuttle is this huge vehicle. It can carry a lot, and they want to stock up the station and sort of keep its, you know, pantries all ready so that it can keep going after the shuttle retires.
Let's bring NPR's Joe Palca into the conversation here. He's in our studios in Washington. Joe, we're a little more than 3 hours from the launch. They haven't scrubbed it yet because of the weather. What else could go wrong, just so we know?
Well, of course, there could be a technical problem, although they say the launch has been going extremely well. You know, everything's quiet is what they say. There's no chatter about any of the problems. You have to understand that it's not just the weather at the launch site. It's not just what's directly over the launch pad. Mm-hmm. It's also what's in the glide path in case the shuttle doesn't make it to orbit and has to turn around and come back to Kennedy. It's also the weather in southern France and Spain, where there are alternate landing sites in case it doesn't have enough energy to get into orbit, but it does to get across the ocean. And it has to be good at Edwards Air Force Base in California and White Sands and or White Sands, New Mexico, in case it makes it once around and has to land. So there's a lot of weather variables, but the only one that seems to be a problem right now is the general area around Florida.
You know, something, Joe, I have a question for you. I gather it's something of a protective issue that there are only four astronauts on this shuttle. Usually there are seven or eight, and you would have thought on the last mission there'd be, you know, the full cabin.
Right. Well, this all goes back to the idea of rescuing the crew. This mission was supposed to be on standby for STS-134, the last mission, and it was the rescue vehicle to rescue that crew if there was a problem. There's nothing standing by to rescue this crew. So these four people is the total number that can be returned to Earth safely aboard the Soyuz and camp out at the space station if something goes wrong and they can't return to Earth on the space shuttle.
Okay, thanks very much, Joe Palca. And let's go back again to the Johnson Space Center in Houston, where NPR's Wade Goodwin is back on the line. We hope a better phone line. Wade, what's happening there?
Well, it's fairly quiet. People are walking around, talking to each other. Everyone looks fairly confident. It's calm. It's interesting. There doesn't seem to be much tension. People are talking and chatting and waiting for launch.
It's a momentous moment, as you were telling us earlier in the day, but I guess this is the part in the sequence where everybody's busy, and so they're thinking about the job rather than the history.
Yeah, I mean, the tense part hasn't started yet. We're still a couple of hours, not a little less than that, away from launch. So, yeah, everyone's at. There's a lot of hands on keyboards, and there's a lot of double checking going on.
I understand you have a NASA spokesman standing near you. Is that correct, Wade?
Yeah, this is Kelly Humphreys. He actually works on Mission Control Florida. I'll hand the phone to him.
Mr. Humphreys,
hello.
Welcome to Morning Edition. Good morning.
Thank you. Good to be here.
So you work on the floor there at Mission Control. How many years have you done that?
I have been doing that for about 25 years now.
Almost as long as the shuttle has been flying then.
Well, I came here for the first shuttle mission that I worked with, STS-26, after the Challenger accident.
So what? Well, goodness, which was, of course, a great tragedy and also a major milestone in the program. What's it feel like to be seeing off the last one, possibly in about 3 hours from now?
Well, you know, the mood here in Mission Control is calm, cool, and collected. About the only thing we're on pins and needles about is the weather, and I know you've been talking about that. But the folks here got a weather briefing, and the crew got the same briefing a little bit earlier, and it looks like we've got a good chance to go off. But in general, folks are focused on the work at hand. They're ready to take over control of the mission once it lifts off from launch pad.
Should we just be clear here, though? I mean, if something goes wrong, if something is found to be wrong, you can call this off until the final seconds if you have to.
Oh, exactly. So we can even call it off after the three main engines have ignited 6 minutes before liftoff, 6 seconds before liftoff.
Well, we'll just have 6 seconds. Wow. Well, we'll just have to stand by and continue talking throughout the morning. Thanks very much. If I can get you to hand the phone back to Wade Goodwin.
You're welcome.
And Wade, if you're there, what is the impact of the end of the shuttle program on the community there in Houston, where the Johnson Space Center is located?
It's a big impact. I mean, thousands of jobs will be lost here. You know, it's already started. And that's just the civil service jobs. I mean, there's thousands of jobs who are dependent on that. I mean, the tens of millions of dollars in local impact, it's hard to know how much it's going to be. But, you know, the economy in Texas is better than it is a lot of places. And the energy industry especially is going great guns. So, I mean, yes, there are a lot of rocket scientists here. But in addition to being rocket scientists, there are petroleum engineers and all kinds of different electrical engineers, different kinds of engineers that can take their skills and take them to other places.
All right, Wade, thanks very much. That's NPR's Wade Goodwin at the Johnson Space Center in Houston. The reference to jobs being lost, a reminder that we do not know what, if anything, will replace the shuttle program. We'll continue following this throughout the morning. Special coverage on many NPR stations of the shuttle launch at 11:26. If it happens, it's NPR News.